The statistic that screams out most from our ongoing prison crisis is that 1 out of 4 people reoffend within a year of leaving prison. Behind that staggering statistic lie stories of horror behind bars, overcrowding, rampant drug use, mental and physical health issues, lack of respect, and all coupled with a crumbling prison estate. What does it say about us as a society when punishment takes precedence over rehabilitation? What are the consequences of a prison system stretched far beyond its limits? And what are the implications, both within and beyond prison, of a moral climate that undervalues respect? To discuss these critical issues, I'm joined by one of the UK's leading experts on prisons, Professor Alison Liebling. She's Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Cambridge and the Director of the Institute of Criminology's Prisons Research Centre, and has spent more than 3 decades studying the moral and emotional landscapes of prison life. A 3-year Major Research Leverhulme Fellowship gave her the opportunity to review that 35 years of research. What insight is there that she can offer into what makes a prison humane? How can we improve outcomes and reduce recidivism? And why does dignity matter, even behind bars? Just before we begin, the We Society, you get an invitation to appear on this podcast. What's your first thought?
Yes, I like the We word, or the We Society word, I guess for 2 main reasons in relation to my topic. So the first is that, of course, prisons are the ultimate example of non-we thinking. So when we punish, we tend to exclude. There's a sort of basic question at the heart of punishment, which is, are we talking about a we society, or are we dividing ourselves into us and them? So I think that's a good framework. But also inside of prisons, the same question is true, that are staff and prisoners, for example, us and them? Or are we all human beings together trying to find ways of rebuilding our society? And is that what prisons are trying to do? So I think it's a very relevant podcast topic.
Your research builds towards trying to compel not just social science, but actually policymakers and the world beyond to take prisoners' experience of prison and prison officers' experience of prison seriously, not just, you know, within the citadel of the prison walls, but actually because what it says about us outside the prison walls. Can you just unpack that for me?
Yes. I mean, lots of people have said that if you want to know a society, then look inside its prisons. And we're not doing very well at the moment. And I think I had to learn the question about how important prison officers are and how complex their work is for myself. I think when I started doing prisons research, I was very interested in quite specific problems like prison suicide and the link between what prisoners did inside and outside. But one particular project, it was the implementation of a new system, a quite politically driven system of incentives and earned privileges, showed up real differences on prison wings between prison officers and the way they administered a new kind of internal punishment system. And that raised lots of questions about what it was that prison officers were doing and what the difference was between the ones who did it really well and the ones who didn't. And so back in those days, it was possible to go from one research project to another. And the then Director General of the Prison Service was really interested in this question about prison officers. And so I had an opportunity. It was not very well funded, but instead of funding, we got freedom, which was in a way of much more value. And 2 of us went into a prison, a high security prison, and were just given free rein to just explore the work of prison officers. And we learned that what was in the books was wrong. Quite a lot of studies of prisons were very disparaging about prison officers, saw them as kind of, you know, the invisible ghosts of penality, the administrators of punishment. But that wasn't what they were doing at all. It was actually quite highly skilled work. And I've now used the term masterpiece to describe prison officers at their best on a wing where everything is held in balance. I think it's completely undervalued and misunderstood as a type of work.
How bad is it in a British prison?
There's variation. So there are still some outstanding prisons or prisons that are managing to make things work. But in general, we've seen since about 2012-13 a move from what a colleague and I call from presence to absence in relation to staff. So you need staff to be present and engaged and professionally confident for a prison to work. And quite a lot of that has changed, and staff have retreated slightly. There are fewer of them. All the experience has gone, and there's a high attrition rate. And so you can see a disintegration in order and a increase in violence and drug use and so on in a lot of prisons. It's a serious concern. So the prisons that are working well require an enormous amount of effort and energy and imagination and innovation. So I think although there are really good prisons now, there are fewer of them, they're much harder to find, they're harder to sustain, and the work rate is extraordinary to achieve that against the conditions.
Now, the prison officer. You've written a book on this. So it's kind of, let's hear it for prison officers.
Yes. I mean, writing that book or doing that research, and we used this method called appreciative inquiry, which I knew would suit beleaguered prison officers who were a bit at the time suspicious of or defensive about being researched because they tended to assume that researchers were more interested in prisoners. So we used this process. It's quite a creative method that encourages prison officers to talk about their best day at work. Tell me something about the best day you've ever had at work, or a time where you've really got it right with a prisoner. And this was really refreshing for them and exciting for us because they talked about the work they do to create order on a wing. And it's work that they often take for granted. They often describe it as common sense, but it's only common sense to them because they've learned how to do it and they build their relationships with prisoners and they become really good decision makers in context. So one of the reasons why I was interested in prisons is because they're places where the edges get reached very quickly and things have to be named and they're quite intense places. So if you work in a prison and you do it well, you become quite a refined observer of human nature. You start to be able to read signals and atmospheres. And it's those sorts of things that prison officers can do really well. And they have to be able to learn all that before they can make really good decisions about individuals. Do I let this prisoner out of his cell today? Do I keep an eye on him because his mental health doesn't look very good? Do I give him a job? They make exceptions and use their discretion in the interest of creating order and peacekeeping. And it's really complex stuff, but they almost don't even know they're doing it because they so take it for granted. But it's really hard work.
Sounds to me, without putting words into your mouth, that actually the paeans of praise from the Trump administration about the dark, brutal prison in El Salvador, no lights, no prison officers, and you're entombed.
Yeah.
You'd say that would work?
Not in the slightest. I mean, people used to refer to the British tradition of staff-prisoner relationships. And I think it's hard to articulate this well in the current climate because people think relationships sound soft. But our work on prison officers, and we wrote this in our book, showed that power flows through relationships. And we're talking about right rather than good relationships. And prisoners are much more likely to accept authority if it flows through respectful relationships. So it's the route to order. And you can see, I mean, in an instant, I give lots of examples in the book I'm finishing now of prison officers who can prevent a fight. They can prevent an act of violence by intervening between two prisoners, put the knife down, mate. And they use the word mate because they have a relationship with that prisoner. And they know he doesn't want the consequences that are going to follow. They know he's had some bad news. He's losing. He's getting frustrated. They wade in to this kind of turbulent emotional whirlpool and manage to bring the atmosphere from attention to order. And that's the kind of skill I'm talking about.
Aristotle's Prison is the title of the book you're currently working on, having written The Prison Officer, The Quest for Humanity and Justice. I mean, this is, you know, after 35 years of kind of ploughing this furrow, that's where you're landing, is it?
Yes, it is. I got a Levy Hume Major Research Fellowship, which I was thrilled about, which has given me some time to pull the strands together of my research life. And there was something building in me. I was seeing some patterns that I wanted to make sense of, and I didn't have time to put it all together and write it up or think about it properly. I was, in a way, on a bit of a treadmill of doing one major project after another. They were all getting more difficult. Some of my colleagues have said heartbreaking, because we were watching prisons disintegrate. And I needed to stand back, pause, and extract the positive lessons from the work I've done over the years. It was almost for therapy, because I was finding it harder and harder to continue to do research in prisons.
You managed to develop metrics which allow you to measure where morality stands in varying prisons. I mean, it's extraordinary kind of voyage you've been on. And actually, hats off to you as a social scientist.
Thank you very much. It's been a sort of accidental journey. And so it makes sense, like lots of things do, like people's lives, they make sense backwards, but it wasn't a plan. And what happened was one project led to another. So I was on a kind of cumulative search. And a couple of times, so when I was studying suicides in prison, I think for the third time, it started to show up that the moral climate, I'd learned how to conceptualize and measure that by then, was related to suicide rates. And you could see that what prisoners said mattered most tended to be moral values. Because we're not atoms and our lives are very much about how we are relating to and being treated by other people. That's what came out of our first attempt to try and measure the quality of prison life. It was prisoners who named the dimensions that matter most. So respect, humanity, trust, support, order, all those sorts of things. And then we've spent various projects trying to operationalize those concepts in a way that suits the prison environment. And it turns out you can turn all that into a tick box questionnaire, and the figures seem to work. And governors tell us they recognize their prison when we show them the results. We put them on a graph. They get a little figure with scores on respect.
The magic score is 3 point.
Well, in the end, we've taken all of this data from all of our prisons, because the prison service have been using the survey over a 10-year period, which is a lot of data, and we've related that to outcomes. So 5 violence outcomes, which include suicide, homicide, serious assaults, and self-harm, and shown that the moral climate, as measured by our survey, is statistically significantly related to these 5 violent outcomes. And so we've identified a threshold above which the rates of violence are much lower, and a threshold above which they're much higher.
You know, I've often wondered about, you know, what it must be like to be 5, 10, 15-year sentence, you know, and you're sharing with someone else. And that's just where it begins.
Yes. That one of the things that's happened as I've been writing this book is, for the first time, I've written a chapter at the end on the philosophy of punishment. And I think putting everything together and thinking about it has really made me question the concept of punishment and the purpose. Like, the suffering that I've witnessed isn't the suffering that we claim we're delivering. When we punish someone, we say we're depriving them of liberty and that they shouldn't be deprived of any other rights like privacy, safety, and so on. But actually, we're doing much more than that. And we're doing, I think, we're creating much more suffering today than we were when I first started doing prisons research. We're putting far more people in prison for far longer periods. We're depriving them of hope. They have entanglements in incredibly complicated sentences. The system doesn't work for them, so they can't get out. And all of this is over and above what we say we're doing in a court when we deprive someone of liberty. And so the whole process of getting to where we are now has made me think about the value of punishment. And I think we really need to revisit it. It's supposed to be a kind of moral enterprise. And it feels as if we need a complete return to basics, to rethink whether the point of punishment is to uphold or build social order. And it feels to me as if the way in which we're punishing is undermining it.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organisation behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. What's a good enough prison?
Yeah.
That's one of your own phrases.
Yes. A good enough prison is safe. It's got purposeful activity, enough staff to deliver a meaningful regime, and it's got a sense of purposeness. And so it's a place that's not too big, where people have a cell of their own, where staff feel professionally confident, and good work is done with prisoners.
And you would argue that such a kind of mini civilization within a prison has implications not just for the inmates and the officers, but actually for the wider society.
Yes. I think it's funny because I've ended up using the term soul quite a bit in my book.
And soul?
Soul. S-O-U-L. Soul. Because even though I don't have a religious background, but prisoners use it. And they talk about how it blackens your soul being in a place like this. And, you know, I've been led to Aristotle through my work in prisons, partly because Aristotle talks about the city-state, and a prison is like a little city-state. And he talks about the difference between a city-state that helps us kind of grow good souls versus a city-state that destroys us. And I feel like that's what I've been seeing in prisons. I can see they are very different from each other, and they've been quite different over time. And in a way, reading his work has helped me to clarify the relationship between the moral climate and outcomes. And I think what I've seen in prison is an intensified version of what happens to all of us outside in our communities, that we either live in societies that help us to flourish and grow and connect and sort of find the better part of ourselves, or we live in societies where that's impossible and that we become damaged and violent.
So the task ahead is to create this network of city-states within prisons. Where does restorative justice sit with all this?
Yes. Well, first of all, to go back to your last point, I think I would say that when we think about the relationship between the prison and the outside world, obviously a good city-state wouldn't need as many prisons as we have. So I think the first job is to reduce our reliance. The prison is supposed to shore up the building of a we society when the mechanisms that we've created outside aren't working. And so it should be a last resort. So I think anything that works well in prison should actually be done outside. And quite a lot of what I'm describing as good practice in prison should probably be transferred to life outside of prisons.
I'm so struck that kind of in this studio, you know, talking about need for respect, what Archbishop Canterbury Rowan Williams talks about, reverence,
yes,
in a secular sense,
yes,
this kind of value system,
yes,
should underpin
absolutely
the prison system if you're going to successfully rehabilitate people, and we're certainly not doing that.
Yeah, and I've used Rowan Williams's work, his little book on being human, because he, and I put him in the first chapter because the framework is that we're losing our sense of the human. And I can show you what that looks like in a prison, but I'm concerned that it's also true of our lives
outside. How does it look like in a prison?
The way it looks like in a prison is that we become, some criminologists have coined this term, the new penology, which is bureaucratic and aggregate and risk-oriented, and it has trouble with the concept of humanity. So it's all about managing the system, and you get lost in a system, it grows too big, And there isn't any room. So I start my book with a prisoner saying to me, it just doesn't make any sense, Alison. And it doesn't make any sense because the system doesn't compute because it can't treat him as the whole person. And it's so destructive to be treated as a thing. And the system has become very thingy. And people are... one of the chapters in the book is about anger and the creation of anger in a very hostile I-it prison. And I think human beings sense phenomenologically their own treatment by others. And something inside us screams. And it's either distress or it's violence, but it's something. And we know when something feels wrong. And that's what I've gone in and seen. And it was always there, but there's more of it.
Would you describe yourself, I mean, you obviously are a social scientist, but how would you describe your approach to morality in social science?
Well, I think someone's pointed out that when I was doing research on suicides in prison in the very early days, I was kind of driven by a kind of moral concern. So I've never been a neutral, distant kind of variables scientist, but I've always respected social science methods. I love the systematic and I quite like numbers, but now I realised over time I only like numbers if they have the qualitative real bit of real life in them, and then I think they work. So I'm a kind of qualitative quantitative synthesizer, and I've always felt like social science is only meaningful if it pays proper attention to the kinds of beings humans are. We're kind of messy and non-linear and complex, and we have inner lives. And I like the kind of social science that works on that. But I don't think that excludes using quantitative methods, but you have to do both.
We all have our inner lives, our inner demons in prison and outside. You don't want to call yourself a kind of moral philosopher. You want to call yourself something different. How do you? Because morality is so kind of interwoven in everything you've been saying.
Yes. So what I've ended up saying, I've written a chapter on my evolving methods in this book, and I call what I do, I'd like to call what I do, moral social scholarship.
Moral social scholarship.
Yes.
As opposed to
moral science, which is the original term for thinking about morality in kind of scientific ways. And I've been quite deliberate about avoiding the term science because of scientism. Because sometimes, for example, going back to the use of the term soul, I discovered that when Freud was translated into English, his term Seele was translated as mind rather than soul, because mind felt more scientific. But of course, from that moment on, we lost his meaning because we translated it into the wrong word. And I think that's what science does. Science aims at something that all rests on a false understanding of what a human being is. And so I like the term moral social scholarship because it's trying to do the lot. It is trying to be rigorous and systematic and count things, but it's only meaningful if what you're counting is the real. And that means deep, complex human experience, and that you have to co-create your categories with the people whose experience you're interested in. You can't come down from somewhere lofty and decide you're going to measure people's experience. You have to do it ground up. So I've kind of developed, I landed on this term and thought, I quite like this.
Das Seele, the German, I'm surprised that translators translated that into mind and not...
Yes.
It translates to soul. It does.
Yes.
That's the German for soul.
Yes. Bruno Bettelheim has written a book about it called Freud and Man's Soul. And he explains, I think it was an American translation, and a decision was made not to use the word soul during that translation, and then everybody's been reading the version of his work that has mind in it. There's been several articles written about it. I got quite excited about tracing this because it felt like, I don't know whether you know Ian McGilchrist's work.
I know.
I really love his recent book, which is The Matter with Things, where he describes how we're kind of committing social suicide because we've chosen, he uses the language of I, it, We've chosen to kind of become, to look at everything through scientific spectacles instead of the humanities are about revealing what is essentially human. And I feel like that's what I'm doing. I didn't set out to do it, but that's my instinct. And I feel like I've got somewhere with it. And it is a form of social science.
If you're going to sell all this to the Department of Justice and the Lord Chancellor and kind of the legal establishment, you're going to say it delivers results. Can you say that your approach delivers results?
Yes. Well, in relation to prisons research, we've been able to show that moral climates are related to reconviction rates, to violence, and at the other end of the spectrum, to personal development. So I've got different case studies using the same kind of basic framework. And in the most positive two chapters in the book, I try and show how above a certain moral threshold, prisoners describe, long-term prisoners in particular, describe the journey they go on and end up kind of finding themselves and reflecting morally and doing all the things that the Ministry of Justice want them to do. But instead of it being imposed by short-term programs, slightly coerced, it's a natural process, like a plant that grows. And you have to provide all the right conditions. You need light. And I'm arguing that human light is reverence. It's attention and deep regard of others. And in that light, we grow naturally.
I'm just going to finish off by asking you, as I do some of our guests, if we gave you a day in which everything you urge could be translated into policy, what would it look like? What would be the first few things you did?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would do, and I have said this to the Justice Committee, is create a little expert group to go into prisons, finding all the prisoners who've got stuck, who are serving 35 years, who don't need to be there. Their risk has reduced, but they're caught up. They're in the wrong prison, or they've found they can't do the programs they need to do. I think we could take a lot of people who are serving very long sentences out of prison through the processes required to build their networks outside, and just give the system some breathing space. I think that's really urgent. The first thing you have to do is take the ceiling down. While people are unable to find a place, there's people who end up being driven around the M25 because there isn't a place for them to go. You can't improve anything. So there's a kind of emergency brake that has to be put on the system. And then after that, I would look again at some of the things that we're taking for granted, like that big and cheap is a good idea. I don't think it is. And reconsider our reliance on the prison and try and shift out of prisons some of the best practices and work with the lived experience community, trying to recreate better lives outside.
Professor Liebling, thank you very much. It's been very compelling. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Nuffield Foundation and Leverhulme Trust. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.